Blog Talk Radio.
I was toting my pack along the dusty Winnemucca Road when along came a semi with a high-end canvas-covered load. If you're going to Winnemucca, Mac, with me you can ride. And so I climbed into the cab and then I settled down inside. He asked me if I'd seen a road with so much dust and sand, and I said, listen, I've traveled every road in this here land. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the deserts bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. Of travel I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Reno, Chicago, Fargo, Minnesota, Buffalo, Toronto, Winslow, Sarasota, Wichita, Tulsa, Ottawa, Oklahoma, Tampa, Panama, Mattawa, La Paloma, Bangor, Baltimore, Salvador, Amarillo, Tocopilla, Barranquilla, and Padilla. I'm a killer. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the desert, bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. Travel, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Boston, Charleston, Dayton, Louisiana, Washington.
It's time for the next edition of the Riveting Jumble Justice Radio Show, broadcast worldwide on Blog Talk Radio. Turn up your speakers and listen closely since you may be asked questions later. Keep your phone handy, since we encourage you to call in your comments to the host and guests on today's show. The listener call-in number is 347-996-5983. Once again, the number is 347-996-5983. You will also find the number on the top of the homepage for the Jumble Justice Radio Show. I'm Audrey, your technical and spiritual advisor for the radio broadcast. And now, without further delay, allow me to introduce your eminently qualified and inspiring host for Jumble Justice, Professor Keith Haley.
Audrey, thank you so much. We could not do it without you. Here it is August. You should be on vacation, and you're here working along with Mike Sorrento and Lucy Spears. So we thank all of you for helping us get the show on the road, so to speak. And Johnny Cash, we better tell him to be careful out on those freeways if he's driving around Ohio now, because they've upped the speed limit to 70 miles an hour. And actually, our trucks, I think, drive pretty good, our truck drivers. But it's the other people that are zooming around them at 85 and 90. So be real careful out on the freeways now, since that speed limit's going up about 5 miles an hour. 5 miles per hour really means it's going up about 10 or 15. But anyway, I don't like speeding. You probably know that by now. I'm your host, Keith Haley, and we want to thank Johnny for doing this opening number for us. It's a wonderful song. And I heard someone comment the other day about it. I heard a woman sing it on one of the Sirius XM channels, Willie Nelson station, and I was surprised. I'd never heard this woman sing before, and as a matter of fact, I can't think of her name, but anyway, it was very interesting, and that Johnny Cash sang that song from memory, and I challenge you, as I've done many times before, to take a look at that lyrics, those lyrics, and see what you can do with it. It's very difficult to do. All right, the purpose of this show is to talk about some of these things, news issues, developments in this field of criminal justice, and we've got some things to talk about tonight. Tonight we're going to take some perspectives on crime and look at some different things that you might not be familiar with or up to date on. We're going to be talking about, can technology actually predict where crime is, therefore allow us to deploy forces? And I've got my name on a couple crime analysis books that studies where crime occurred, and then, you know, what should you do? But could we actually predict, using technology, where our forces should be deployed? And people are working on that right now. And in other words, where the next crimes are going to be committed. So we're going to have a little segment on that. And then we're going to be talking about the prison population that's actually going down in some places in the United States. But we dedicate this show to these police, courts, corrections, and juvenile justice professionals that keep us safe. And they do a marvelous job altogether. We have people that foul up every now and then, but what field doesn't? All right. You're listening on Blog Talk Radio, and you can get your own show in less than 3 minutes. It says that right on the website, I think. And Alan Levy is the CEO of BTR, and he's the genius that created this thing where now I think there are 184,000 radio shows on Blog Talk Radio. Isn't that absolutely amazing? So anybody, any interest group, whether you're talking about cigars, wine, rabbits, whatever you want to talk about, you can have your own radio show and do that. So get your own show. If you don't like those 184,000 other ones that's on there, you can do whatever you want to do. What we're going to do tonight, if you have some listener calls, we have time for that. I don't think we will because we never do. It's 347-996-5983. It's 347-996-5983. And you can also call in 347-996-5983. That's the one on the website. Okay, we've got a blonde joke tonight. And Lucy, I think you've got one for us, don't you? A blonde joke, a pretty good one? Let's see what Lucy has to say about blondes tonight.
What do you do when a blonde throws a grenade at you? Pull the pin and throw it back.
pull the pin and throw it back. Now that is a hoot. Lucy, I think that's the shortest one we ever had, but it's a funny one. If a blonde throws a hand grenade at you, pull the pin and throw it back at her. Better be careful, though, Lucy. You know, we don't want to talk too much about that kind of thing on the radio. The FBI will show up or some other federal agents. They have a news story about that tonight, about some guy that was, we'll start off with that one, I think, or some guy and his wife. He was looking for packs, and she was looking for pressure cookers on the Internet. And guess what? People from the Joint Terrorism Task Force in the area actually show up. Well, just so people in Chicago understand, the criminals, we're going to play this for Chicago and some other places, but this is the Ohio Gun Coalition's warning that they should turn in their firearms. I'm sure this is meant for the criminals, and I'm sure it's worked marvelously over the years.
Carrying concealed handguns in Ohio? It's a deadly idea. A message from the Ohio Coalition Against Gun Violence.
Thank you much, Ohio Coalition, and keep up your good work. I'm sure that as criminals hear this in, on their radio stations between their music songs and whatever, they're probably thinking they should get out and turn in their firearms. Well, we have a green tip tonight, and I'm doing this one myself. And here's what the green tip is for tonight. I like this one. If you have school children and you send your children off to school and they have food and it's packaged, give them bonus points to bring the packaging home. You will prevent littering on the playground and you can recycle it at home. What an idea. Put your kids' stuff in a bag, let them go to school, have their lunch, and then bring the stuff back again. It's just a wonderful idea. It is. Thank you. And that comes from Ms. McCloy's book, 1001 Little Ways to Save the Planet. What a great thing. Well, let's look at some criminal justice news tonight. And boy, there are some interesting things out there, as there always are. If you got the Internet, you can study news in China or Russia or, you know, Greenland, even Greenland. Yes, there are people that live in Greenland, I think. I wouldn't swear to it. But let's take a look at some of these news stories tonight. Here's the story about Michelle Catalano. Yes, Michelle Catalano. And she was looking for information online about pressure cookers. Her husband, in the same time frame, was Googling backpacks. Wednesday morning, six men from a joint terrorism task force showed up at their house to see if they were terrorists. Can you believe that? Which prompts the question, how did the government know what they were Googling anyway? Oh, I think we know that answer. Anyway, they were peppering my husband with questions, Ms. Catalano says. And she's a professional writer, by the way. Where is he from? Where are his parents from? They ask about me. Where was I? Where do I work? Where do my parents live? Do you have any bombs, they ask. Yeah, like I got my back room full of them, right? Do you own a pressure cooker? My husband said no, but we have a rice cooker. Are those still legal, Audrey, rice cookers? Probably. Can you make a bomb with that? My husband said no. My wife uses it to make, what, quinoa?
Well, he's Cornell. the federal agent actually said that, right? The task force agent, he says, what the hell is Cornell? Have you ever looked up how to make a pressure cooker bomb? My husband, ever the oppositional kind, asked them if they themselves were curious as to how a pressure cooker bomb works. If they ever looked it up, two of them admitted that they had done it. The men identified themselves as members of the Joint Terrorism Task Force. The composition of these task forces all around the country, after the Boston, they include federal agencies and people from local agencies too, and you assign them that. Detective Garcia of the Nassau County Police, however, told the Atlantic Wire by phone that his department was not involved in this in any way. Back to the Attorney General of California, I don't know if it's still true, but unless you have reasonable suspicion that somebody's involved in a crime or doing something wrong, they're not assigning anybody to these federal joint terrorism task forces. But these task forces deputize the local authorities as federal marshals, and then they go out and work with them and do this type of business. But isn't that incredible? So watch what you're doing on the internet. I mean, you know, because we do know that people are listening. This one is too much. The Homeland Security Department, the federal, has lost track of more than 1 million people who they know arrived in the United States, but who it cannot prove left the country. According to this audit, and this was released Tuesday a week ago, that also found the department probably won't meet its own goals for deploying an entry-exit system. Well, that's not what, just think about that. That's only 1 million. I kind of wonder if you're that far off, how do you know how many are here to start with? But they're saying 1 million people they've lost track of, not 100,000, not 1,000, 1 million. DHS has not yet fulfilled the 2004 statutory requirement to implement a biometric exit capability, but has planning efforts underway to report to Congress in time for the fiscal 2016 budget. So they were supposed to be doing this in 2004. They'll be ready with an answer in 2016. Let me see if I can do that high math. That's 12 years that the Department of Homeland Security will be on top of this. I don't know. Is there something wrong there? What is going on? I don't know. This is kind of funny. I won't spend much time on it because it's sort of a long story, but little tiny small police departments all over America. This is Morven, Georgia. Small town police departments across the country have been gobbling up tons of equipment discarded by a downsizing military. They've been getting bicycles, bed sheets, bowling pins, French horns, dog collars, even a colonoscopy machine, regardless of whether the items are needed or will ever be used. In this tiny farming town in Georgia, Morven, Georgia, the police chief has grabbed three boats, scuba gear, rescue rafts, and a couple of dozen life preservers. The town's deepest body of water is ankle deep. It's an ankle deep creek. The Associated Press investigation of this Defense Department program, this discharge of equipment to other places, originally aimed at helping local law enforcement fight terrorism, drug trafficking, found that a disproportionate share of the $4.2 billion worth of property distributed since 1990 has been obtained by police departments and sheriffs, often in rural areas, with few officers and little crime. I mean, I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this. The article goes on and on about the kind of things that they're getting. But the Morven police chief, for example, has acquired a decontamination machine. It's originally worth $200,000 for his community of 700 residents and two additional full-time officers. The high-tech gadget is missing most of its parts and would need $100,000 worth of repair. I hope they're doing it. He also got a shipment of bayonets. One of the guys in the town says, storekeeper says, are you kidding me? What the hell are they going to be doing with this? That's a quote, by the way. But anyway, something else. I'm not going to go into this one because you've heard about it so much on news, whether they're conservative stations or not. But NASA is allowed to search with no prior authorization through vast databases containing emails, online chats, and the browsing history of millions of individuals, according to documents provided by whistleblower Edward Snowden. And you saw that Russia just gave Snowden amnesty, so he can stay there. He's finally out of his airport hotel room in Russia. I don't know how long he's going to stay there or what they're going to do with him, but that's something. George Zimmerman, can we forget him? I tried not to comment about him, but they stopped him in Texas for speeding. And this was, what little town was this in Texas? Forney, Texas. It was about midday, and they stopped him for speeding. And they checked him and saw that he was free of arrest warrants. He says, I'm going to go back and check you. They check and find out nothing, but he did have a gun with him. He says, the cop told him, just take it easy, go ahead and check your glove compartment and don't play with your firearm. See, that's Texas. They don't worry a whole bunch about these guns. Anybody in Texas, for example, can carry a sawed-off shotgun, as long as the barrel's not shorter than 18 inches, in their vehicle concealed. You require no license whatsoever. And I don't recall hearing about a lot of people being blown away by people with shotguns. I used to have students there in Texas that drove on. They had shotguns in their car. They never shot anybody whatsoever. But anyway, that's incredible. Did you know that recipients of federal disability checks often admit that they are capable of working but cannot? Recipients of federal disability checks often admit that they're capable of working, but they cannot or will not find a job that those closest to them tell them they should be working, and that working to get off disability is not one of their goals. In other words, they don't want to do this, but I want to thank you for paying your taxes, listening audience, because that is really that's really important. Oh, I love these correlation studies. We now have a study. Where did this one come from? The Harvard School of Public Health. Where else? Drinking several cups of coffee daily appears to reduce the risk of suicide in men and women by about 50%. So now drinking several cups of coffee a day is a suicide prevention thing. You know, I've also found out, I haven't done a detailed study of it, but people that are under 4 feet tall are less likely to commit suicide than people over 5'6". Duh. Can you believe this? Just because two things are related, it doesn't mean that one thing causes the other, right? You've heard me say it. Hot tar and diaper rash, they have a high correlation, but one doesn't cause the other. So anyway, but drink your coffee. If you drink 4 cups of caffeinated coffee, it has to be caffeinated. Of course, there's probably 95 studies that show there's something wrong with that, right? Caffeinated study. It's going to help your brain. It affects your neurotransmitters in the brain in some positive kind of way. This is one that I almost can't believe. The new NASA, or NSA, it's not NASA, NSA's new spy facilities are 7 times bigger than the Pentagon. One of these guys works at one of the 3-letter intelligence agencies and oversees construction of a $1.2 billion surveillance data center in Utah that is 15 times the size of MetLife Stadium, home to the New York Giants and the Jets. Long Island native Harvey Davis, a National Security Agency official, needs that the commanding presence, said, we need this. His role was to supervise infrastructure construction worldwide for the NSA, which is part of the Defense Department. So the facility in Utah is 200 acres. Then they're building this other one on the East Coast in Maryland. That one's 28 acres. Together, the Utah Center and the Maryland Center, which is 20 acres, and the computer farm out in Utah, is 220 acres. And some of these guys that are working on these things don't even know what they're building. They don't even have an idea what they're doing, but somehow they know it's about snooping. So we're going to be hearing a lot more about this here in the future. One more story, well, two more, actually, and we're done. An investigator views the scene of a school bus crash in February 16th, 2012, near Chesterfield, New Jersey. The federal authorities now think that we should be putting in automobiles the ability for each car and each truck, each bus to communicate with each other. In other words, you can talk to people going down the road out of your, in your vehicle. Now, we got cell phones, we got a network radio, we've got texting while driving. So now we're going to be talking to drivers while we're going down the road, people behind us, beside us, in front of us, etc. I think that idea is absolutely insane, but we'll see what happens. Ladies and gentlemen, we have a first. San Francisco allowed a man to plead guilty after running down a 70-year-old man, Suu Kyi Hui, in what is believed to be the first conviction in the United States. He was on his bicycle, and they got him on a manslaughter conviction. He was going down the hill. He couldn't stop, and he hit this guy, and he killed the 71-year-old pedestrian. Biking in San Francisco, given the hills, if you've ever been there, is a little dangerous anyway. So I think you take a little extra precaution not to do things like that. They said that their goal was to send a message to cyclists about safety. I think that's been a problem for some time in San Francisco. But anyway, that's a first in the United States, at least they say it is. But I know that people have been involved in all kinds of traffic violations in Central Park in New York City. So I don't know if anybody was seriously injured, or certainly nobody killed there, although bicyclists get killed all the time. I bike all the time. By the way, I wanted to mention this. If you're in the Ohio area, in Ohio particularly, and you have not been to New Bremen, Ohio, and seen the Bicycle Museum of America, you are missing something. They have thousands of bicycles there, 300 of which are on display all the time. It is a fantastic museum. Even if you're not interested in bicycles, you will get interested when you see some of these things. I like the big wheel bikes, the double wheels, and they were real long, and they had a rack on them for the Kentucky rifle, powder rifle. It was kind of interesting. But I didn't know that bicycles a long time ago in Europe and some in the United States didn't have wheels on. Some of them didn't have wheels on them. They had legs on them and boots. So when you pedaled, these legs moved, and it made the bike move along the road. But it is a fantastic place. And, you know, I'm not on call for New Bremen, but if you haven't been to that town, it is absolutely spotless. The downtown area is beautiful. And what happened there is that Crown Manufacturing Company, I'm not sure that's the exact name, but they make forklifts and lifts for big seaports and all that for lifting thousands and thousands of tons of freight. They bought out the Schwinn Bicycle Museum of America in Chicago in the 1990s when Schwinn went out of business, and Crown moved all that to New Bremen, Ohio. But it is absolutely fantastic, and you will enjoy that. They don't try to sell you anything in the store. There's a Crown store down the street that has some paraphernalia and clothing, hats, that type of thing if you want to do it. And the hosts of that place are just outstanding. They start off by showing you a 14-15 minute video, take you around, explain all kinds of things. They're absolutely great. We're very gracious and talented people. So if you're in New Bremen, Ohio, it's off of Interstate 75 on Route 274. You go down there, and I think, being a village and seeing what I saw, this is a pretty wealthy community. Then down on the other side of 75, you keep going east, is that what's the name of that little short trailer? I can never think of the camper. I'll think of it in a second. But anyway, it's about four blocks long. They got tons of them parked out in the... Anyway, they make that little silver camper. People have seen it before. Okay, that's our news stories for tonight. And I'm going to talk to you about some other books. If you haven't read the book, if you have any interest at all about human behavior and relating that to the world of the internet and computer hacking, this book called Social Engineering by Christopher Hadnagy, Hadnagy, is really a very fascinating book. Now, it's some deep reading. It's a little bit repetitive, but it is very interesting, a very interesting book. There's another book I'm reading also. I'm always reading too many. This one is by Chris Kyle, and this is called American Gun. I may have mentioned this to you before. It's a history of the United States and 10 firearms. And you open the book cover, and the inside the book cover is the 10 guns that this talks about. But it is a wonderful history book about all the different battles, and starting with the American Revolution, going right up into modern times with these various books. So I think you would enjoy any one of that. That one's called American Gun by Chris Kyle, K-Y-L-E. And he's the Navy SEAL who was killed by the guy that he was trying to help. He took him out on a shooting range, and this guy was suffering from some type of stress from combat, and he ended up killing him. A really terrible, terrible story. Okay, what we're going to look at here first tonight is this issue of software predicting crime. And it's a relatively new area, and we're going to have to see how this plays out. But give me time to set this up, and we'll let you listen to this, and we'll make some comments when it's over.
Support for NPR comes from the Ann Arbor Area Convention and Visitors Bureau, providing details on dining, shopping, and the arts in Ann Arbor. More at visitannarbor.org/NPR.
Some police departments are trying to predict the future. They're using software that lays out statistics from the past to project where crime is moving. Police in Los Angeles say it has worked well in predicting property crimes. Now, Seattle is about to expand it to gun violence. But as we hear from NPR's Martin Costi, police are hesitant about relying too much on computers.
This all started as a research project. An anthropologist at UCLA, Jeff Branningham, wanted to see if computers could model future crime, the same way they model earthquake aftershocks. Turns out they can.
It predicts sort of twice as much crime as any other existing system, even going head-to-head with a crime analyst.
Older systems, like the famous CompStat in New York, show where crime has been. This looks forward.
The model will actually predict other locations that effectively say, even though there was a crime somewhere else in your environment, the risk is still greatest in this location today, in the next 10 hours or the next 12 hours.
Branningham and his colleagues are now selling this predictive system to police departments. They call their product PredPol. And at this point, you're probably already thinking about the sci-fi movie Minority Report. But this is different. There are no psychics living in bathtubs, for one. But more to the point, this isn't about predicting the who of future crime, just the where.
These red boxes are predictions of where the next crimes are likely to occur.
Police Sergeant Christy Robin pinches and zooms on a map of Seattle. Earlier this year, the city started using PredPol to predict property crimes. Now it's expanding the system to predict gun violence, too. It's the first place to do so. At the start of every shift, patrol cops are assigned to the boxes on the map.
So we're asking that they spend time in that 500 by 500 square foot box doing whatever proactive work they can to prevent that crime.
Let's walk down. This is the spot to park. We're going to park here.
Officer Philip Monzon has just pulled up inside his box. Today it's a city block near the Seattle waterfront.
They want visibility, they want contact with businesses as they're appropriate, anybody that's wandering through the area. So here we go.
This area has a lot of parking lots, and PredPol's forecast includes car thefts. As Monzon passes a green Honda, he pauses. The guy inside seems to be ducking under the dashboard.
Or if he's going to pull out anytime soon.
The car starts. The guy probably does have the key. But why didn't Officer Monzon challenge him, just in case?
I don't really have enough. I'm not going to just single out one guy in a Honda.
And here's where this gets tricky. The courts say police need reasonable suspicion in order to stop somebody. That suspicion can come from a lot of things, even someone's furtive movements, as the police like to say. But can it come from the fact that someone is occupying an imaginary red box drawn by a computer?
No. No. I don't know. I wouldn't make a stop solely on that.
That's probably the right answer, says Andrew Guthrie Ferguson. He's a law professor at the University of the District of Columbia, and he's taken a special interest in the constitutional implications of PredPol. He says the departments using it have told police not to use it as a basis for stops, but he wonders how long that can last.
The idea that you wouldn't use something that is actually part of the officer's suspicion and not put that in may come to a head when that officer is testifying and either is going to have to omit a fact that really was the reason he stopped or she stopped the suspect, or is something that they will then admit on the stand, and then the issue will be raised for the court to address.
And it may be that PredPol is a constitutional basis for stopping someone. Some might see it as more objective than a cop's judgment, less prone to racism or other kinds of profiling. Ferguson says that is possible, but we need to be careful.
I think most people are going to defer to the black box, which means we need to focus on what's going into that black box, how accurate it is, and what transparency and accountability measures we have to it.
In other words, even though computers aren't biased, the stats feeding them might be. And he says if we're going to follow an algorithm, we should at least be willing to check the math. Martin Kosky, NPR News, Seattle.
Well, it's an interesting idea, isn't it? I'm not sure that this thing is going to work. I mean, I have great faith in police officers who are very carefully selected in both small, medium, and large police departments across the United States. They go through the most detailed selection process that you can have, and of course they should use technology to assist them. But on the other hand, a good beat police officer that's worked an area for 5 or 6 or 7 years, these are people who can pull up behind an address in the alley because they know virtually every street address on their beat. And they know people. They know when somebody's going to work 10 minutes late. I mean, they know when unusual things are there, so they can define what reasonable suspicion is. And I think depending too much on some of this technology is actually going to keep them from working their beats. And good patrol car officers spend some time out of their car on their beat, even in cities that are busy. Maybe not Detroit. I was reading here the other day that Detroit, I heard on the radio, that Detroit now takes almost an hour for somebody to answer a 911 call, if you can absolutely believe that. And some Detroit police cars now do not have, can you believe this? Do not have computers in them and radios. They're depending on the officers using cell phones. I mean, what in the world is going to happen to Detroit? Detroit should be a center of study for everything that could possibly go wrong with the city. And I don't mean that in a hateful way, but we should look and see what went wrong in Detroit. And I hope that city recovers. At one time, it was a great city. You've heard them say, in 1960, this place was on top of the world. I've known cops from Detroit and administrators, and what in the world went on. Okay, what we're going to do now is take a look at the falling incarceration rate in the United States. One thing that's happening with that is that folks are kind of out of money. So we're trying to reduce the prison population and save, you know, crime is essentially down. It's not peak, but got a little bubble here off and on the last several years, but we really have overall the lowest crime rates we've had in 50 years, and most people don't even know that. But what's behind these falling incarceration rates now? These new stats show the number of prisoners in the U.S. continues to fall. So what's behind the new trend? And is this thing here to stay? So we're going to listen. He's going to speak with Vikrant Reddy from the Right on Crime and Nicole Porter from the Sentencing Project to talk about that. Now, they have their own
They have their own perspectives about this, but we'll let you listen and see what you think.
Support for NPR comes from Back Bay Books and Little Brown & Company, publishers of J.K. Rowling's novel The Casual Vacancy, now in paperback.
This is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin. Later in the program, we'll talk about elections set for Zimbabwe, where 89-year-old President Robert Mugabe is hoping to win yet another term, despite or maybe because of what many people call an increasingly abusive dictatorial style of governance. We'll talk about that in just a few minutes. But first, we want to talk about an issue that's become a central focus of activists in this country. It's the incarceration rate. It might surprise you to know that the U.S. leads the world in the number of people locked up in jails or prisons and the rate of incarceration, that according to the International Center for Prison Studies. More than 1.5 million Americans were in state and federal prisons last year, according to the latest numbers from the Department of Justice. But that number was actually down from the year before. And in fact, it's the third straight year the number of prisoners in the U.S. has declined. We were wondering what's behind the trend and what it might mean for other important issues that have eluded political consensus. So we've called on two people from different sides of the political spectrum who've been watching this issue closely. Biklot Reddy is a policy analyst for Right on Crime and the Texas Public Policy Foundation Center for Effective Justice. That's a conservative think tank. Nicole Porter is the director of advocacy for the Sentencing Project. That's a group that's been working to lower the incarceration rate for some time now. Thank you both so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you. It's nice to be on.
Nicole Porter, if I could start with you, how did the U.S. get to be the world leader in incarceration, and why has a group like yours, among others, been so aggressively trying to change that trend?
Well, the U.S. got to be the leader in the world's incarceration rate because of very harsh sentencing policies, such as mandatory minimum penalties, truth in sentencing penalties, and three strikes and you're out. Laws like what's famous in California and other states that have habitual offender laws as well. So our penalties trigger very long prison sentences in this country, and that has changed dramatically over the last 30 to 40 years and has led the U.S. to have the highest rate of incarceration.
Why now is this trend reversing?
We've been documenting changes in policy and practice for about 10 years and would say that the trend started about 12 years ago. We're only now starting to realize the decline in the prison population and in the rate of incarceration because people are sentenced to very long penalties. So the changes in policy and practice have taken a while to actually be seen in state prison population.
Margaret Reddy, what's your perspective on this? Why do you think this trend is now reversing after such a long move in the other direction?
One of the primary reasons that incarceration is dropping is simply that crime is dropping. So when you have less crime, you will possibly, not definitely, you'll have less people locked up. Now, I say possibly because it's also possible that we sweep too many people up and we ignore the fact that crime is dropping. But luckily, that's not happening. What's happened is that this has sort of changed the political environment. So whereas this used to be a really contentious issue and things like, oh, the Willie Horton ad and the Bernie Getz incident and all of these famous criminal law stories from the last 20 years just dominated headlines, they don't anymore. And so people can talk more about improving parole and probation and drug courts and other alternatives.
We spoke with somebody at the Heritage Foundation, which is a conservative think tank based in Washington, D.C., and they said that incarceration rates are dropping in part because so many people have been locked up in the past, so that's kind of removed, if we can use this term, kind of a criminal cohort from the streets. That has helped lower crime rates, which has then created the space that you've talked about to actually start seeing the trend that we are seeing now. Vikrant, do you agree with that?
There's something to that. It's obvious that if you lock more people up, you're going to have less crime just because you've incapacitated people. But, of course, the problem is at a certain point you're going to get diminishing returns. You can just start locking up far too many people, and you find that those dollars could be more wisely spent elsewhere, maybe in programs that would reduce recidivism rates and things like that. So I think that's correct up to a point, but we've probably passed that point, and we're really at a stage now where we need to reduce this heavy incarceration, heavy and expensive incarceration burden, and happily it looks like that's happening.
Nicole, I haven't forgotten about you, but Vikram, could you talk a little bit more about why you and your group believes that the point of diminishing returns has now been reached? Because people have associated, I think, the conservative side with these tougher
sentencing policies. That's not always strictly true. For example, New York has had a very high incarceration rate, very tough drug laws in the past, which has been considered a more, you know, liberal state. For example, even liberal leaders there, like former Governor Mario Cuomo, endorsed very tough sentencing policies in part as an alternative to the death penalty. So that's not a strict, you know, correlation. But why do you think, and why do you feel that other conservatives like the ones in your group, Right on Crime, now believe we've reached the point of diminishing return?
It's research-driven. You know, you talk about New York, and New York's got its problems, but in a lot of ways, New York is really kind of a great role model for other states. You look at some of the micro data over this period when incarceration has increased across the United States, and there are periods where in New York, I think from 2000 to 2010, incarceration actually was reduced. Now, on top of that, their crime rate fell. So when you look at other states where incarceration increased and the crime rate fell, and you try to say, well, there's an obvious correlation here, you're able to turn to a state like New York and say, no, New York did different things in terms of policing and other strategies. And it's not necessarily the case that increasing incarceration is leading to decreases in the crime rate.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Vikrant Reddy of Right on Crime and the Texas Public Policy Foundation and Nicole Porter from the Sentencing Project. We're talking about this country's declining incarceration rate. Nicole, your group has long thought that we've reached the point of diminishing returns with the rate of incarceration, the number of people that we incarcerate in this country. So we understand that that's your perspective. Why do you think that the trend is going the other way? Is it there's a philosophical consensus around this? Or is it just the budget? Is it we know that many states and certainly the federal government are under a lot of financial stress and that localities just can't afford this anymore?
Sure. Well, it's certainly a mix of things, but we would say at the Sentencing Project that it's a little bit too simplistic to just focus on the recent recessionary period and the budget as what's been the trigger for policymakers and stakeholders to shift their opinion on the incarceration rate. Actually, this work has been achieved over a long period of time in terms of working to shift public opinion, and certainly states have been looking at revisiting the laws that trigger long prison sentences for about 12 years now, since the late 90s.
What is the most persuasive evidence, in your view, that has led to this change in perspective?
Well, we've been documenting at the Sentencing Project since 2004 that lawmakers are revisiting policy and practice in terms of what sends people to prison and their length of confinement. Why we are seeing declines in the prison population over the last 3 years is because the prison sentences are very lengthy and it's taking time to realize how those changes in practice have impacted state prison populations.
For people who are not familiar with this area of policy, what is the most persuasive thing you can say to people that say we lock up too many people for too little reason for too long of a length of time?
Well, for a long period of time, prison populations continue to rise, and policymakers realized that the budgets were also increasing as well, and that wasn't impacting public safety in an effective and efficient way. And there were more effective alternatives, such as community-based alternatives, that also realized lower rates of recidivism.
So, Vikrant, what about you? In the couple of minutes that we have left, I mean, we are in a particularly polarized political environment now. Is there something that you could point to in this area that might foretell something else, some other areas in which you think that there could be some advancement or agreement on something that's as important as this?
In areas
if there's some lesson that you think that that can be learned from what's happening in criminal justice, either philosophically or in a way that people can approach an issue?
The lesson really is the importance of looking at the data and making sure that you focus on what the research is showing you as opposed to maybe preconceived ideological notions. I'm talking to you from Texas. It's my home state. It's also Nicole's home state. And we've managed to shut down a prison in our legislative session 2 years ago. We authorized two more prison closures just this past legislative session. The number of people incarcerated in Texas is dropping, and Texas has the lowest crime rate it's had since 1968. It's one thing when Vermont does it, but when Texas does something like this, the ultimate sort of tough-on-crime state in people's minds, I think it really speaks to them. It shows them that you can get real successes doing this stuff.
What would you say to people who just don't believe it? I mean, they believe that just locking up people is the way to address crime, even for offenses that, you know, some people consider to be it used to be said that drug crimes, for example, people thought those were victimless crimes, and other people made the case that they actually aren't. There are all kinds of social ramifications that you know, need to be addressed through incarceration. What would you say to people who are skeptical of this?
I think we should draw a reasonable line between violent and nonviolent crimes. I mean, violent people need to be locked up. There's this old saw in our field that I know Nicole probably knows, where people say we need to focus on locking up the people we're scared of, not the people we're mad at. Now, the people we're mad at, you know, I don't think we should just let those offenses go. I think that they need to be punished too, but I don't think that incarceration is really the best way to do it very often. Things like drug courts and effective parole and probation, these things would go a lot further than incarceration would in improving those social problems.
Nicole Porter, what about you?
You know, the United States sentencing practices are far out of step of similar situated countries. And the reason why we do have such a high rate of incarceration is because even for violent offenses, our penalty structure is very harsh. So in order for us to look at the incarceration rate, and if we're troubled by it, as the Sentencing Project is and as many people are, that's why we're seeing these changes in policy and practice. Not only do we have to address nonviolent offenses, but we also have to address how we address violent people sentenced to violent offenses as well.
What about people who say, so what? So what if the U.S. is the leader in the incarceration rate? What about people who say, so what?
I would just say, well, how should we be using resources effectively? And are there other ways to reduce criminal offending that don't just rely on incarceration? Because we've seen that even in states that have reduced the rate of incarceration, crime has continued to go down. So it's not just about the correlation between the rate of incarceration and crime that's improving or maintains public safety. It's about other social interventions as well. And are there other solutions to social policy problems, such as investing in early childhood education, investing in job training, programs, particularly for high incarceration communities? And I would hope that people who are suspicious of incarceration or who aren't troubled by it would also think that there are other more effective ways to use taxpayer dollars and to use resources towards improving public safety.
Nicole Porter is the Director of Advocacy for the Sentencing Project. She was here with us in our Washington, D.C. studios. Vic Hunt Reddy is a policy analyst for Right on Crime and the Texas Public Policy Foundation's Center for Effective Justice. He was with us from member station KUT in Austin, Texas. Thank you both.
Well, where would I start? But anyway, why is Texas crime down? I think one of the reasons is that they locked up all these people. I mean, Texas would certainly make that point. All this stuff, most people in prison have been there before. They never mention that. Most people in prison have been in prison before, so they are recidivists. Some have been there two and three times before. So what actually works is locking them up. They can't commit more crimes. Now, we've got another issue here. What is the purpose of punishment? Retribution is one, giving them what they deserve. What's this guy deserve, this Ariel Castro character that kept the women in hostage for, you know, X number of years and brutally raped them time and time again? I mean, what's right for him? But anyway, we have tried this before. In the 1960s and 70s, the psychologists took over the prison system. We started letting people out. We started all these community treat programs, and crime soared like it had never soared before. I mean, it went crazy. Crime soared. And what happened? We got to the point where we lived in a very dangerous place. And then finally, cities like New York says, we're going to stop this gun violence. We're going to get these gun criminals off the street, which they did. They had probation officers actually ride with the cops because the probation officer could actually do a search of somebody when the cop couldn't. They would go and they would take their guns, lock them up for long periods of time. And New York City's homicide rate went from over 2,200 a year down to something like 500. That's pretty close to that. Those aren't the exact figures. And we did that by locking them up. And then when we let criminals out, which we're starting to do again now, we'll say, okay, crime is still going down. It won't. These characters that are recidivist criminals are going to go out and commit more crime. I mean, doesn't that kind of make sense? I mean, and then three strikes and you're out. That was the biggest joke of all time. Everybody had repeat offender sentences in the United States, virtually every state. So this idea on your third strike, you got to go to prison for a longer period of time. And the first guy that ever went under California's law went under, I think he stole pizza from somebody at the mall. I'm not kidding. and he was a big, you know, a big case. He was the first three strikes and you're out character. So, you know, the funny thing about sentencing is, you know, don't believe it. I mean, you've heard me say on this show before, when you read about somebody getting a life sentence, don't believe it. I mean, some will do life, some will not, and I will use one more time the example of the guy that killed my friend, Dr. Carte, and he got life in prison for blowing his head off with a shotgun, my friend's head off with a shotgun in a robbery. 1982, he got life in prison, and he got out in 1994. So most sentences you can't believe, because while they're incarcerated, they're going through appeal after appeal after appeal. And that's one of the reasons they're giving this Ariel Castro this real long life plus 10,000 years or 3,000 years or whatever it is. He would be taken care of in Oklahoma and Texas, believe me. And many people think he should have gotten the death penalty. What he did to those three young ladies is just horrible. And he says he's sick. Well, we could cure his illness through an execution, and he wouldn't have to worry about it anymore, nor would people on the street. I hope I don't think he's going to get out, but you see what I mean. So there are different purposes for punishment. Incapacitation is one of them. Retribution, give them what they deserve. Incapacitation, lock them up. I know somebody locked up in a jail cell in Columbus, Ohio, or, Houston, Texas, or wherever they are, they are not going to be committing crimes on the street. They can't do it. And maybe in the prison a little bit, but we should be doing something about that too. Then rehabilitation, nobody's against that. But rehab programs are in prison. We don't have to turn them all loose in the community under probation and parole in order to rehabilitate them. I've never understood that. We have to recreate, you know, put them in a halfway house, which, you know, don't get me started on those things. How'd you like to live in a neighborhood with 25 drug offenders living across the street from you who are living in a halfway house? Some people actually have to suffer with that. They're never the mayors and city council members of these cities or county commissioners that have somebody like that, but some other people have to live with that type of people in the neighborhood, and they are not successful drug courts, the joke of all time. I mean, don't even let me get started on drug courts. But anyway, it's an interesting business. What do you do about crime? I mean, it sounds so simplistic. We have degree programs, many different kind of majors in criminal justice now, but nobody, in my mind, has found anything better than locking up career criminals for a long period of time. It makes the streets safe. You think that wouldn't have some effect on the streets of Chicago, where the Miracle Mile is now being called by the Neighborhood Watch Group up there, the Murder Mile? I mean, welcome to Chicago. I don't think I want to be visiting that. I visited before at conferences and that type of thing, but I don't want to go back to Chicago for anything. Detroit is the same way. Of course, you could buy a good house in Detroit. See, that one was on the market for 5 years that cost $1 and nobody bought it. I saw a picture of it. I don't think I wanted either. But anyway, it's... what are we going to do about crime? And, you know, the other thing that one of these commentators said was this business about, you know, the United States has this more people incarcerated and more crime than many other nations of the world. Well, we're a big nation, and we're also the land of opportunity for both what? The law-abiding and the criminal. Criminals come here, many of them across the southern border, for example, to commit crimes. They're part of drug cartels, robbery teams, I mean, on and on and on. And they come here because we got more stuff to steal. Why wouldn't you come here? I mean, you can move from town to town and shopping mall to shopping mall if you're a shoplifter. I mean, you know, you can do pretty well if you got a brain. A lot of them don't. That's the other problem with the criminals. But anyway, my solution to all this is what? Give them an aging pill. Because if you can make them over 60 or 65, they're participation in crime goes down considerably. And then maybe, well, I won't even comment on that one. You've probably heard that one before too. But anyway, it's an interesting thing, and I don't think we're going to run out of a time when we run into a time when we don't need police and prisons and lockups and that type of thing. But we'll always be exploring new ideas on this. So that's going to be it for tonight, and we're going to let... Vera Lynn, sing her song for us, if I can find it on here. Where in the world did that go? Whoops, I think they, no, they didn't take it off. They just changed something on here. But we'll have Vera Lynn sing her song. We'll meet again. And we won't be meeting next week because of some things I have to do. But the week after that, the show will be back on. Thank you. Good night.
Again, don't know when, don't know when, but I know we'll meet again some sunny day. Keep smiling through, just like you always do, till the blue skies drive the dark clouds far away. So will you please say hello to the folks that I know, tell them I won't be long. They'll be happy to know that as you saw me go, I was singing this song. Again, don't know when, don't know when, but I know.